Trey Gowdy is a best-selling author. He is also the host of Sunday Night in America with Trey Gowdy on Fox News and the Trey Gowdy podcast. But he served as four-term congressman from South Carolina. Before running for Congress, he served as a federal prosecutor in his home state and district attorney in Spartanburg and Cherokee counties. His new book is Start, Stay, or Leave, The Art of Decision-Making, where he shares his framework for decision-making and telling the story of his life through the choices that he made using this method. Again, the name of the book is Start, Stay, or Leave. It is published by Crown. It's a pleasure to welcome Trey Gowdy to the roundtable this morning. Trey, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate that.
Give us the idea behind the book of really your thought that all decisions basically come down to those three things of start, stay, or leave.
Well, the idea kind of hit me just a chance encounter with someone in a grocery store parking lot, of all things. And she used the word fair, which is the description that I covet the most. And it kind of forced me to think, okay, where do I want to wind up in life, whether it's a retirement party or a 50th wedding anniversary or, you know, God forbid, nobody likes thinking about the real end, but somebody's eulogizing me. What are they going to say? What are my friends and what are my family? What are they going to remember? Where am I trying to get to? And it just struck me that the decisions we make, whether it's employment, relationships, they all boil down to a decision. And we need to be really, really good at making decisions. So that's where the idea hit me, is how our decision making kind of impacts our journey on this gift we call life.
Why, in general, or sometimes, are we not very good at it?
Well, we let other people define terms for us. I let, for the longest part of my life, I let other people kind of tell me what a successful life looked like. And we become a prisoner to other people's definition of success, other people's definition of failure. Losing is not failing. Coming up in the next election cycle, there could be 12, 14 people that aspire to be the nominee on one side or the other. I can't accept that offering yourself, conducting yourself honorably, but not ultimately prevailing is failing. So why are we bad at it? We don't know where we're going. I mean, imagine hopping in the car. You got no destination. You don't know where you are trying to get to. Chances are great you're not going to make it. So it's we either let emotion or we overemphasize our gut over logic. I'm a big logic guy. I like to do facts first. Look, it's unavoidable that emotions are going to play a role in our decision making. I'm gonna buy a putter that I think looks beautiful, even if I need something with a little more game improvement. That's unavoidable. But big decisions in life, you should structure logic, intuition, and let emotion pick the music for the ride, but not pick the destination.
Well, since you mentioned politics, let me just ask the question about, so does it figure into your decision? You are a representative. That by nature is the job, a representative. So how does what the people want, how the people feel, factor into that decision? And what are the other things that you have to factor against that?
Mainly that everybody has a different opinion. I mean, whatever district you're in, mine was an R plus, maybe 8 or 9, which means on average, there are more people who identify as Republican than Democrat. But does that mean you just exclude the 42% that have a contrary viewpoint? Do you not listen to them? Do you not hear them out? Do you not try to synthesize the two perspectives? To say you are a representative, you are, but you are not representing a monolith. And the majority, you know, there's a difference between being in the majority and being right. So a lot of folks in my old line of work, you know, get that confused, but you know, there's a difference between having one vote more than the other side and having truth or justice on your side. So I wasn't great at politics. I was much better in the courtroom. But being a representative doesn't just include those who agree with you.
You say you weren't good at it. I guess I'm curious by that and what it takes to, in your opinion, be good at it.
Well, you know, there's a major murder trial going on in South Carolina right now, the Murdoch
right.
case.
Yes.
That fits my eye. Being in a courtroom fits my eye. It fits my desired closing argument in life much better than politics, because not only do you have to get the right person for the right crime, but you have to investigate and prosecute it according to the rules. And you can have the right person and break the rules, and you're not going to be successful. So the process matters in the courtroom. The result matters, and the way you reach the result matters. In politics, the only thing that matters is winning. If I need to run an ad against you, even though it is like 1% true and 99% either not true or not a fair representation of the facts, we tend to minimize that because the goal is to win. We overlook shortcomings in our own teammates, but we're really, really quick to point out the shortcomings on the other side. So to me, it's relativism, at least now for this moment, and nothing would be more antithetical than the courtroom than relativism.
Were you happy to get out?
Oh, my Lord. I mean, I would have left sooner, but I mean, we got to know ourselves. One of my weaknesses in life is friendship. Tim Scott, you know, my best friend in politics, the guy that will preach my funeral, he asked me to stay one more term. And I mean, D.C. is a lonely place. I mean, I don't know what people think, but it is not parties every night with, you know, Hollywood actors and actresses. It's a lonely place. And if you got a friend that you really, really care about and you spend a lot of time, you don't want that friend to leave. So he asked me to run one more time. I did. I probably should not have. So I left after four terms, probably should have left after three.
How much of what we're seeing now, I mean, Donald Trump and the impact that he had, but for people like you who are interested in politics and want to stay in politics, or maybe don't, but maybe would otherwise, what does this, for want of a better word, rain do for people like you?
Rain as in R-E-I-G-N?
Yes, sir.
Well, I think all of the things that were captured by President Trump's candidacy, presidency, future candidacy, existed before him. They may not have been given a voice. They may not have thought they had a candidate. There's a reason that political movements and politicians are successful. And that's because they are meeting some belief structure, something that already exists. I mean, politics to me reflects, it reacts, it rarely leads. So he tapped into something that existed within the Republican Party that nobody else was able to tap into. And what the genesis of that was, I could not tell you.
It's not something that you saw coming or necessarily realized that was restrictive or would restrict you and I guess ultimately aiding in you wanting to head for the exit.
No, I mean it's not just true on the Republican side. It's true on both sides. I mean There's a belief that we can't do anything good unless we win, and therefore winning is most important. I mean, we don't place a priority. The word that I want, the word that I covet the most, the word that the lady in the parking lot shared with me was fair. I mean, do you see anyone in politics being rewarded for fairness? I mean, I can't think of the last time a politician was rewarded for saying, yeah, you know, what the other side did wasn't great, but we got some people on our side that aren't doing great either. 99's a failing grade in politics, and that's true on both sides.
You write in the book, deciding to leave can simultaneously be one of the most challenging and liberating acts. Leaving can be scary, sad, exhilarating, difficult, relieving, necessary, or all of the above. I assume when I read this, and I think if you're leaving, it's what we were talking about earlier, if you leave in Congress, but it's knowing when it's the time has come, right?
Yeah, leaving Congress was not that hard of a decision. Leaving the courtroom was a much harder decision. I mean, people at an airport in Phoenix, Arizona don't know that I was in a courtroom, so they want to ask, why did you leave Congress? The better question is, why did you run for Congress in the first place, which meant you left a job you really did like? And sometimes the job just extracts too much of a price. I mean, if you want to be a really, really good prosecutor, then you have to put the jury in the stead of the victim. Well, you can't do that in a homicide case. It's really hard to do that in any kind of violent crime case. But you have to communicate to the jury what this was like, which means you live it. I mean, you are spending all day with crime scene photos that you can't, and you add in children. It just extracted too much of a toll the way I did it. Other people, seem to be able to do it for longer. But 10 years was, about enough to wreck what was left of my faith, and it was time to leave. That was a hard decision because I loved the job. It was just not good for me. Leaving Congress was not a hard decision.
I guess I'm trying to determine, I mean, you've answered this, but I guess I'm just ultimately trying to determine, is it this Congress, this time, or for example, would you have flourished in another era?
I don't know if I was talented enough to flourish in any era. I think every day was election day. I mean, if you watch the news, watch the political magazines, you listen to talk radio, every day there has to be something that is major. And so that's a lot of opportunities to get major things wrong. I think before that advent of 24-hour news cycles and every day being election day, where the quality of your work, how hard you worked, was more important than how well you did on television. And right now, we see members of Congress that become household names in less than a term. Not because of their work, not because of their ideas, not because they even show up for committee hearings, but because they're good on television.
What do you make, and I ask this question just because I think it's I know it's the story of the day, but it's also, I just find fascinating about people who make it in Congress and people who don't. So if you're in the Republican aisle, And George Santos comes in through the door, what does that say to you about your job?
It probably says a lot of things. I think what it says is whatever the vetting process was in that particular district in New York, the voters wish it were had been more rigorous. What I don't know, and I don't say this lightly or facetiously, I don't know how and to what extent the result would be different now if the choice were Mr. Santos or a Democrat. I don't know because we've gotten to this point of relativism where we convince ourselves that winning is the most important thing. Having the gavel is the most important thing.
Right.
And does this member fill in the blank, whether it's George Santos or someone on the other side, fill in the blank, does this member help us run the show? And so we kind of redefine the virtues that existed 10, 20 years ago. I mean, if he came and sat beside me on the floor, and if he asked my opinion, I would tell him to take the broader view of life. I don't see how he will have any effectiveness at all in his current position. People are forgiving, but you got to ask for it, and you got to show them that you have changed. And I think that's really hard to do in Congress. People are resistant to being told what to do. They're not nearly as resistant to being persuaded what they ought to do. For all the folks that are going on television telling him what he ought to do, I think their time would be better spent going to his office and persuading him that it is in his and everyone else's best interest to go get his life back together and and do it in a non-public way.
Right. Yeah. You mentioned this earlier in our conversation. I think let's end with that. But the trial that is going on in South Carolina with the Murdaugh family, how familiar were you with them? And what do you make of all of this that just seems to be such an incredible fall and a very eerie mystery?
I served with his father. There are 16 elected district attorneys in South Carolina. And when I was one of the 16, Randy Murdaugh was also one of the 16, but in a part of the state about as far away from where I live and where I served as you can. So saw him probably twice a year, maybe. I actually know the current solicitor down there pretty well. He's not a Murdaugh. His name is Duffy Stone, but he's not involved in the case. I look at it. You know, it doesn't matter how cynical you get in life, and I've gotten pretty far down that road. I'm still stunned when parents kill their children. I am still stunned that people can take a weapon to a completely innocent person, no provocation, no even argument of self-defense. When I look at it as a lawyer, I worry, you know, we feel this need to provide a motive. Everybody wants to know why. And it looks like the prosecution is also kind of bought into that we have to tell the jury why he did it. So their thought is he did it because he had so many other things crashing down on him. He'd been accused of stealing from the law firm and therefore stealing from clients, and he had substance abuse issues. To convince a jury that the way to deal with all of these other storms is to commit double homicide, potentially capital murder, is tough. I get that the jury wants to know why. I would spend more time on the what. What happened? They've got evidence. It is circumstantial. But you know what the judge is going to tell the jury? There is absolutely no difference between circumstantial and direct evidence. None. It's not like one is perceived as being more weighty or better than the other. There is no distinction in law between circumstantial and direct evidence. So build your case. But, how can you explain shooting your wife and your son in the head with a firearm? I mean, what would explain that? Problems at work? Mm-hmm. That doesn't explain it.
It sounded earlier that you would like to be in the courtroom. That there's the itch.
I was
that
for
you.
Two decades.
Well, right. That cases like that, you're. I mean, it's not that you're eager to be a part of that, but that's something that is interesting, of interest to you, of what your involvement in that could be.
I wanted to be good in a courtroom. I had a desire to be a good advocate for victims. I liked it. And if you ask me what job I want to be remembered by, it would be that one. It wouldn't be Congress. It would be that one. Ironically enough, I left trying to preserve, some little, not to become hopelessly cynical. That's why I left. I probably had already crossed that bridge by the time I walked out of the courthouse. So, you don't get redos in life. In hindsight, should I have stayed in the courtroom and skipped the run for Congress? I don't know. I didn't. What if I had to do it all over again? That's the great thing about life and making the decisions is once we make them, we got to adjust.
The name of the book is Start, Stay, or Leave, The Art of Decision-Making. Trey Gowdy is the author. The book is published by Crown. Trey, thank you very much for being with us. Thank you.
Thank you. It was my pleasure. You take care of yourself.
Be well. Thank you very much. Trey Gowdy, Start, Stay, or Leave, The Art of Decision-Making. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.